I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Earlier this year, Eddie Perfect had two musicals running simultaneously on Broadway, King Kong and Beetlejuice. The Australian native has been living in New York City, where he joins me from today, fulfilling a dream to write music and lyrics for the musical theater. He's already well known as an actor, playing the role of Mick Holland in the Australian comedy drama program Offspring for 5 seasons. You can see the show on Netflix. He performed his own music on the show, as well as in various cabaret and stage shows in Australia, before making the move to the United States in 2015. I'll ask Eddie about making it in New York and what it's like having two shows on Broadway and how he worked. As well, we discuss the new original Broadway cast recording of Beetlejuice, now out from Ghost Light Records and Warner Records. The album is available for streaming now on platforms like Spotify, and the physical CD will be released this Friday, the 11th of October. Beetlejuice the Musical continues its run at the Winter Garden Theater, where it opened on Broadway in April of this year. King Kong, which opened in October of 2018, closed in August, and will have a life in touring productions, including Japan, in 2021. At Eddie Perfect is the Twitter handle, and the website for more is at ghostlightrecords.com. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Eddie Perfect. Mr. Perfect, good morning.
Hello, how are you doing?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm good. How's British Columbia going?
It's not bad. It's typical BC weather. It's raining. It's damp. But I was in New York last week, and it was really hot there.
Dude, it's still hot.
Is it?
Yeah, it's been like 3 months of summer, and now we're waiting for it to kind of go, next fall?
Right.
But it is hot. It's nice, though.
I guess Australia is known to be pretty hot, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm from Melbourne, which is probably, like the Seattle of Australia.
Yeah,
it's very rainy, kind of London-y weather, but doesn't get quite as cold. But it's an indoorsy cultural city, not like Sydney, where it's like beautiful and you go out to the beach and you exercise in public and do all those sorts of things. But when it gets sunny in Melbourne, there's really nowhere to go. So it's kind of stay indoors, listen to jazz, drink some beer, write your novel, that kind of city.
And so you grew up there, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm from Melbourne, Australia. I grew up there. I've lived a bunch of different places, but Melbourne's still very much my home. It's where all my family is. It's where, that's where I kind of write. And I've been in New York for just over a year now, which is crazy.
Is that a hard adjustment to make to go from, say, Australia to New York and live there full-time, say?
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, it's hard just moving from one city to another in your own country, but, there's a million things you move to another country, and then New York is like another challenge altogether. It's like kind of alternating first world, third world on different days. Some stuff is really modern and easy to navigate, and other stuff is really antiquated. It's kind of a hard city. I've got two little girls, so to get them in school and find all their extracurricular activities and just work out how to navigate the city. But we've done a year of it, and I feel like this year we're doing it a little better. The kids are, doing sports and dance and all sorts of stuff, and we know how to get ourselves around, and we've finally made, a couple of friends, so we don't feel like lonely losers like we were when we first got here. That was kind of hard. The only real friends I had were people that I was working with, but, you finish work and then everyone sort of goes home. It's pretty, it's pretty intense. And you're 17 hours a day in a theater with someone, kind of a little reticent to extend that by going out drinking.
I keep thinking of that song, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. I mean, the last year you've had two shows running on Broadway. I mean, Beetlejuice is still at the Winter Garden there. What is that like? And I mean, not too many people have had that happen to them.
No. And I mean, from the outside, you could be forgiven for thinking, that's a really positive thing. But actually, it wasn't my choice to do both of them in the one season. It's just sort of how it worked out. I started Beetlejuice first, and then I signed on to write some songs with King Kong 18 months later. but they just had this crazy short kind of process, and so they ended up just running in complete parallel, and it was really stressful doing both of them at one time. So I didn't recommend it. I'd try and spread it out a bit. But it was certainly a baptism of fire, that's sure.
I'll bet.
And, you know, like, things went really right, and that was great, and things went really wrong, and that was pretty hard to deal with. It was really stressful and occasionally, you know, borderline traumatic, and I didn't really sleep much, and, you know, I thought I would have to have about, you know, 25 years of hardcore therapy when I got out the other end of it, but I haven't. I'm doing all right. Kong was a much larger kind of machine than Beetlejuice, even though Beetlejuice is a huge musical.
Yeah.
Kong was, like, you know, an epically technical show, and very high pressure. And I was only, you know, I was a smaller part of that kind of wheel, a smaller cog in that wheel, just contributing songs. So, Beetlejuice was very much more, a true American developmental process with, you know, my own music department, and I wrote the whole kind of school, and we were like a real kind of family. So they were very different, I'm pleased to have had both experiences.
Well, when you had to sit down and write the score for Beetlejuice, because it's the source material is a movie that a lot of people know. What was that? Was that a big leap for you in terms of having to come up with the music and lyrics for a show like that?
Yeah, and also, you know, like there's two things. One is that there is a little bit of enmity around for the movie to musical adaptation, which I totally get. Because the first thing you ask is why, you know, and every adaptation can be either the best idea or the worst idea, depending on how it's executed. And when you're pitching on a musical, like right at the beginning, before you've even got the gig, they wanted me to write a song for Beetlejuice and a song for Lydia, and I was like, Jesus, that's the hardest decision. You know, what is Beetlejuice going to sound like when he sings? I mean, Lydia seemed a little clearer to me because, you know, the idea of a 15-year-old sitting on her bed with a Fender guitar plugged into a little amp and playing kind of moody, angsty grunge music was something that just sort of made sense to me instantly. And I wrote a song for her dead mom, which is still in the show, as part of the pitch. But Beetlejuice was harder because in the page, on the script, written by Anthony Scott and Anthony King and Scott Brown, the script was so funny and so surprising and so able to just turn on a dime. Beetlejuice would be, you know, seductive and then charming and then hurt and wounded and then angry and then loving. And, you know, like, he was just a wild character on the page.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew that if I wrote a song for him that started in one groove and just stayed there, you know, we'd be dead in the water. It would undo all their brilliant work. So I set about writing a song, which is also still in the show, the opening number called The Whole Being Dead Thing. And, you know, it was a real kind of Frankenstein's monster. It had, you know, every single genre of music you could think of, often, you know, alternating from one measure to the next. It was a really, it was like kind of herding cats, that song. It took a long while to make it make sense as a song from beginning to end. So that one came really hard, and even though I write quickly, I think I spent, you know, a hardcore sort of 3 weeks turning myself inside out to create that song. But I'm glad I did it because it kind of, A, I got the job, and B, it sort of broke the back of how Beetlejuice might sound.
Yeah. The thing is, you described that song and the various elements in it. It's very pleasant to listen to. It's clever, it's witty, it's wise even. But yes, I can see it here as a listener. What a challenge that might be for the writer.
Yeah, I mean, you can just keep adding genres on and just go, okay, this section's going to be, you know, swing jazz, and this section's going to be banjo folk, and this section's going to be rock or ska or dancehall or whatever, you know, whatever other genres are in there. But, you know, it takes a lot of work to kind of make it feel of a piece, of one piece, that it kind of, that isn't, you know, every song at Beetlejuice is an argument song in some way. Mm-hmm. To build that argument from the beginning to the end. So that was, you know, it took a lot of, it took a lot of doing, but there was, you know, the idea of, you know, there's one section which is like very much like a folky ukulele moment. And then it just has one bar of 7/4 of just flat out death metal, and then comes back. And something about that odd time signature always managed to completely catch people off guard right from the beginning, and that was very useful. So we use that quite a lot in the show.
So it is a lot of hard work, a lot of long hours. What was the most fun in terms of the process of writing the music and lyrics to Beetlejuice?
Well, I mean, there are so many. I mean, for those people who are listening that are writers themselves, I mean, you know that it's mostly in the beginning quite a solitary endeavour.
Right.
And I don't know. In Australia, you know, there aren't that many people. So when you make something, you know, when I write a show and then I tour it, and often I do sort of solo stuff, I'd have to turn around and write a new show pretty quickly because you exhaust your audience pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, you know, I kind of got used to the feeling of loneliness of writing on my own. And I write in Logic, and so I used to write everything at a piano, but now I write in Logic, and so I sort of build the entire arrangement and the song as I'm writing it. And what that gives you is an ability, you know, to kind of improvise vocally, or to at least experiment vocally, to kind of get into the character, to act that character, and to make sure it's coming out the right way. And what it kind of eventuates is this sense of kind of divine solitary madness. I mean, I spent months and months in a big boomy kind of hall that I rented with a microphone under a blanket to stop the echo of the hall getting into the mic, just being Beetlejuice, being Lydia, being Delia. And, you know, you get to a place where it's very unselfconscious, just kind of creating these musical worlds, and I really, really love doing that. But then that's the meat of the iceberg, and the tip of the iceberg, the really fun stuff, is when you bring it into the room and you start collaborating and you start making discoveries with the cast, and you hear it brought to life by a band. I mean, that's a magical moment. Searching for a joke with your book writers and collaborating on comedy and you know, the art and sort of science of comedy is just absolute joy to me, being in the room. I love it. And then, you know, collaborating with an orchestrator and you know, getting to do a sits probe with the cast and hearing the cast and the orchestra together for the first time is, you know, for anyone that's ever written a musical or been in a musical knows that that's kind of the moment where you leave the rehearsal room where you've had, you know, a piano the whole time, and you suddenly get an orchestra, and it's like going from black and white to colour. It's a very exciting moment. Seeing it on stage is an amazing moment. Seeing an audience and hearing an audience laugh at jokes is a moment of both excitement and complete relief, because, you know, you're only really going by your own instincts at that point. So there are so many things that are exciting about it. And what was exciting about me was this was a massive step up in terms of just the available resources. You know, I went from writing music, lyrics, book, you know, musically directing my own shows in Australia, to having a, you know, to having a team, to having a musical director, an orchestrator, somebody, a dance arranger, a choreographer, you know, all of these incredible collaborators to work with. So it was a huge, terrifying, but ultimately kind of exhilarating step up.
Well, you've described a career or a job, if you will, that a lot of people have dreamed of. I'm not sure if that's what you thought of, how you envision, say, your life turning out growing up. Because, I mean, you're a well-known performer in Australia, an actor, a singer, and the sort. I mean, it's a different sort of career now that you're in the United States. Is it what you could have imagined it to have been, though?
It was kind of harder than I thought it would be, and a little more kind of brutal than I than I thought it would be, but you know when you ask, like, you know, is this sort of a dream to do it? To be honest, It was not an early hell dream. I've always loved music theatre, but it was sort of parallel to my life. I wanted to be a visual artist, and then I kind of left visual art to be a performer, and then I studied music theatre. I sort of discovered composing composing for theatre while I was at drama school. Mm-hmm. I always really loved music, and I've always been, had a good ear and been, just had a kind of a natural affinity with music. But, you know, I grew up in suburban Melbourne, and the idea of ever being a Broadway composer was not something I dreamed of, because it just was something that didn't happen to people like me. I didn't even know anyone that wrote songs, let alone wrote musical. But yeah, it just seemed like a job that other people do. You know, and Broadway didn't even seem like a place so much as like a kind of a bizarre nirvana state of mind. And I didn't actually go to New York until I was 31 years old, and I got married here. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it was always sort of like a kind of a mystical place. So, and now it's very real. But so that wasn't always a dream, but it has been my dream to write for musicals. And then, you know, as I wrote more musicals in my native Australia, you naturally start to want to seek out larger, more opportunities. And it was maybe 5 years ago that I literally just booked a ticket to go to New York and started taking meetings and meeting people and seeing shows and trying to jam my foot into as many doors as I possibly could to get on that mysterious writer list in the sky.
So we get the idea in our head of what a writer of musicals, you know, how they work in the sort from you know, movies from the 30s and 40s. Penthouse apartments, say, overlooking the park with a big grand piano and the sword and you know, looking elegant like that. Is it like that for you?
No, it's not. I kind of had a suite set up in Melbourne. I had a little shed at the back of my house, and I did have a baby grand piano in it, and it was my own little space, and, you know, I could close the door and get away from the kids and stuff, and it was... you know, it was nice, you know, drop the kids at school, come home, write, pick the kids up from school, you know, that kind of vibe. Mm-hmm. But since I've been here, I mean, our apartment is tiny, and we're, you know, living in each other's pockets. And I've gone back to, like, I've kind of regressed to my situation when I was writing maybe in my early 20s. I've got my wife and I have a bedroom, and in the corner is a little desk with a keyboard in front of it. And I write in the corner of my bedroom, and I don't have a particularly amazing view of anything, but I certainly can hear a lot of construction and sirens while I work, so that reminds me I'm in New York. So yeah, it's kind of cramped and less than ideal, but that's the kind of way it goes. I mean, I had a bit of a moment where I was like, you know, like I'm a Broadway composer now, and I'm literally shoved in the corner of my room, you know. But you could look at what I'm looking at now. It certainly doesn't scream glamour. You know, I hear stories about other composers, you know, having these massive apartments, but, you know, and they need to earn a lot more money than I am currently earning to be able to get anywhere near that. New York is, like, crazy expensive.
Mm. Yeah. It was just like Vancouver, I guess. The other thing that I was thinking about as I was listening to the cast album was you grew up listening to cast albums in Melbourne. And
yeah.
So what was that process like in terms of putting it together, recording it? I mean, I don't know, if was it over one night? Was it over a couple of nights? And sitting there and you know, listening to other people play your music, sing your lyrics.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. I mean, so I grew up on cast recordings, amongst other things, but, you know, I very, very clearly remember going into my dad's vinyl collection and pulling out, you know, the original cast recording of Godspell and Fiddler on the Roof and Jesus Christ Superstar and, you know, My Fair Lady. I mean, I remember Fiddler on the Roof especially just going, what is this music? I mean, I never heard anything kind of close to resembling kind of Jewish Yiddish folk music, and it blew me away. And the first CD I ever bought when CDs came out, and I'm showing my age now, was Stephen Sondheim's Company. Mm. You know, and I listened to that ad nauseum, just trying to kind of break down what was happening. You know, what are the singers doing? What's the orchestra doing? You know, what are these orchestrations? How is it working? And you know, just sort of really living inside these cast recordings and imagining these worlds. So it had always been like when I was doing Beetlejuice, and I always had my eye on that this part of the process. I'm like, this is the bit where you get to add your little bit of cultural credit into the great big pot of Broadway music theatre. You know, whether it's a success or it's a failure, you know, it exists, irrefutably exists, and other people can experience it and listen to it. And also, it was an opportunity to make a representation of the show that people back home in Australia could hear, because, you know, I'd been, you know, 5 years and nothing that anyone back home would sort of know about. Sure. So, and also it was good to kind of get the show out of that sort of New York theatre bubble and get it into the ears of people all over the place, you know, all over the world, really.
Yeah.
And the process was, it was really exciting. So we recorded the orchestra first. We had 2 days with the orchestra, and, you know, all set up and playing all together, you know, but totally isolated. That was really exciting. And then we had 1 day with the singers, one kind of long day to nail all the vocals. And then, you know, the mixing process was really interesting, because, you know, a lot can kind of go wrong between tracking your score and putting it out into the world. And, you know, we knew that we were making this kind of score that was like not entirely like a typical Broadway score, in that it used a lot of contemporary styles. And in order to make them sound authentic, you know, they need, sonically, it needs to represent what's out in the world. Like, if you're going to do, you know, a Beyonce-style drum line, it needs to sound like, you know, it needs to sound like something you would hear if you listened to Homecoming. Or if there was, a dance hall moment or whatever, you know, you wanted it to kind of have a stack up against, you know, Major Lazer kind of sonically. It didn't want to make an anemic music theatre version of that. And that meant, you know, making sure that a whole lot of technical things were taken care of, that, you know, the bottom end was well looked after, that the sort of energy and drive and clarity in all the instruments, and that, you know, that the whole thing lived inside its groove and felt like something that, you know, you could listen to even if you weren't, say, a theatre literate kind of music theatre kid, you know, something right. That felt like it would straddle all those worlds satisfactorily without people going, oh, this is a Broadway musical. So that was, you know, complicated and hard, but we had a really exciting team and amazing cast, professional cast to work with, and the whole thing was a total dream. And since then, you know, the album has really kind of taken off outside of the New York theatre world. You know, like, kids are, you know, have you heard of a thing called TikTok?
Right, right.
There's an app called TikTok. Like, well, basically, I think kids just sort of mime to songs in character. Beetlejuice is very popular on that platform. I've got like 25 million videos of people doing little bits from Beetlejuice songs, which is so cool, and people discovering the album every day, and an unprecedented amount of kind of creative response to the album, which none of us anticipated. Like, the entire backstage of the Winter Garden Theatre is covered in artwork, people drawing their favorite scenes or song moments. We have people making animatic animation of certain songs, or even some full flat-out animations of songs. There are like thousands of kids doing covers of the songs. I mean, this is stuff that has never happened to me before. I've never found this kind of audience for my music before, and it's like totally lovely. It's really exciting to see people immersing, you know, technologically it's different nowadays, the way that people do that, the way that people express themselves, but it's the same thing as when I was a kid, you know, and I put Fiddler on the Roof when I was in a bloody shtetl, you know, and I was like inside that world. Or, you know, when you put, you know, a cast recording on in the car when you're driving your kids around on a family holiday, like That's how I listened to a lot of musicals when I was a kid. That's how I heard Sweeney Todd when I was 8 years old on a, in a combi on the way to the Grampians National Park in Victoria. You know, you live inside these theatrical worlds where music and theatre kind of are married in a really intellectual, satisfying, emotional way. And to be able to contribute to that and have people experience Beetlejuice score on a family trip, I mean, that's just outrageous to me. It's such a cool thing to have happened.
I'll bet, yeah, and to think that, I mean, you know, more people will probably listen to this and see it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, for example, they every now and then someone sends us figures on how the physical CD doesn't exist yet.
Sure.
But it's coming in October. So it just exists in sort of digital form and on streaming platforms. But last week, 6.5 million individual streams of Beetlejuice. So that's a lot of, yeah, that's way more people than will ever come to see the show listening. And, you know, that's, you know, what else, well, geez, what else can you ask for?
Yeah. And it is, I mean, all the work that goes into producing an album like that, I mean, there is a lot of work, obviously, a lot of care, because that is the record of the show, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, you know, like whenever it's sort of 4 a.m. and you're discussing him. I mean, I remember we got the final mix and, you know, I listened to it on about, you know, 30 different sources, from car stereos to different headphones. And there was something about it that was bugging me, and we were really at a deadline where we needed to press go and send it to master. But it wasn't right. I rang Matt Stein, who not only was a producer on the album, but produced the music for the theatrical show as well. He's a really talented guy. And I remember ringing him and going, I don't think this is right. I feel like there's something's happened with the mastering where it's gotten kind of muddy and we've lost focus and clarity. And he was like, really, he was really angry at me. He was like, well, you need to be specific. You can't just tell me these things and just, you know, like just these vague things. And I was like, oh man, I don't know how to explain it. I'm like, just have a listen, and if I'm wrong, and if I'm going crazy, my ears have just packed it in, just tell me. And then like, about an hour later, I get a call from him going, yeah, no, you're right. So we went back into the mastering studio and did a whole other session, the whole part of it. Because you're like, this is it, man. This is like, you know, they only get one chance to do the original Broadway cast recording, and then that's it forever, you know?
Yeah.
So I was damned if I wasn't going to turn myself absolutely inside out to make it what I was hearing in my head and make it the best representation of the show, because that's it in posterity forever.
Yeah. And it's something that you can look back at years from now and have all sorts of memories about going to New York, about, you know, going to Washington, trying it out there, and then bringing it onto Broadway. It's all there, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's all in there, and, you know, and there's like and the same amount of material again. There's at least an album's worth of songs that were cut for the show along the way for various reasons. So who knows? Maybe in the future we'll make a companion album to Beetlejuice with all the cut songs. We'd literally write another musical, you know, with the songs that were cut. So it was a long. I mean, I never worked on anything for that long, 4 years. I mean, that's not even particularly long for a Broadway musical, apparently. But Jesus, it felt long from my perspective, and that's certainly enough time to fall out of love with a song.
Right.
So it was, it was a really long, protracted, but very kind of forensic, detailed journey, and a lot of it I can't believe it happened. It was just absolutely extraordinary, and now I'm really back where I was when I first started Beetlejuice, like just trying to start some new projects, and it's hard, man, when you know that, like, you're staring down the barrel of at least sort of 4 years of development. It's like, all right, here we go. Let's go back underneath the surface of the water to the big bulk of the iceberg, and so we can work our way back up to the tip.
Yeah. Is there anything that you can tell us about in terms of these projects that you're working on now?
Well, not really. I mean, I'm kind of at the stage where, you know, I've had a couple of ideas, and I don't really like to just sort of pitch an idea until I've worked out if I can write it, you know.
Right,
like, so
right.
I could go, I want to write, you know, I don't know, Gospel of St. Luke, the musical or something, whatever the hell, is a hypothetical. But if I haven't actually attempted to write any of the songs, I'm not confident that that it's going to be worth anything. So I'm writing a few things now, and my hope is to is that they're exciting enough to me and exciting enough to somebody else with money who might want to climb on board and produce it from the start. And it would be really exciting to, you know, having done an adaptation of a film with Beetlejuice, do something that's completely original so that we don't have to worry about, you know, the duality of those two worlds. You know, will fans of the film like it? Is it faithful enough to the film? Is it enough of its own thing? You know, how do we resolve some of these rules? Are we telling the same story? All that kind of stuff. You know, it'd be nice to just find an idea and see where it leads.
See, I was wondering, Eddie, while you're writing the music, whether it's Beetlejuice or King Kong, are you listening to other composers, other albums, say? Are you going to see other Broadway shows at the same time?
Absolutely. I mean, I kind of go and see lots of stuff. But a lot of the music I listen to isn't music theater. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one project where I've been listening to a lot of sort of Eastern European pop and sort of Balkan folk and Hungarian choral music, and, you know, like trying to immerse myself in that particular world. Is another piece where I'm listening to a lot of sort of English, 1800s music, kind of like classical choral stuff, like boys choirs and stuff like that. Benjamin Britten. It's good to be able to. I mean, I like to listen to a diverse sort of range of music anyway, but I find that listening to too much just Broadway, Broadway is a kind of a weird bastardization of music. You know, you're sort of taking music and you're manipulating it in order to tell a particular story. And I feel like if you kind of start to listen to that and copy from that, it's sort of like you sort of, I don't know, like it sort of feels like a facsimile of a facsimile of a facsimile.
Right.
You know, music theater isn't a style. It's an umbrella under which literally any style of music can exist. So to try and kind of keep my ears and my brain ticking, I just like to listen to a whole bunch of new music and new sounds and see if they sort of bubble up when I sit down to write a particular idea.
In preparing for our chat, Eddie, I started watching Offspring on Netflix.
And, oh, no way.
And Mick is a very different character, I'd assume, from who you are. Is he really?
I think he's like a less motivated, less successful version of me. I think I did like 80% of my scenes lying on a couch. And, you know, like he's sort of like, I think in the early seasons, you know, he was sort of offsetting a fairly lethargic music career by doing landscape gardening and odd jobs and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a, you know, I'm a laid-back person, but I'm also pretty, ambitious. And I, apart from my family and a very sort of small circle of friends, I don't really have much life outside my work. I really do sort of put it all into my work. So I think I'm kind of different in that respect from Mick. But he certainly is a version of me, because I got cast in that show, in the pilot of that show, and then from that point on, the writers really just wrote to us. So it was a bit of a gift, you know, just to turn up, and I didn't have to, you know, put on a hunch or a Latvian accent or, you know, imagine being a eunuch or anything difficult like that. It was just a kind of a lazy version of me.
What was it? Was it a fun show to do?
Yeah, it was really great. I mean, it was a hectic time of life. It was sort of in my baby-making time. My eldest daughter is 10, but she was 2 months old when I did the pilot. And then my second daughter, Charlotte, we had, I think, sometime during season 4. A lot of the other cast had babies along the way as well. It was a nice sort of time. And that time was, you know, like me being, I was still obviously still writing while I was doing the show. I mean, the show was sort of structured as such that I did like maybe 3 or 4 shoot days a week, and the rest of the time in and around that was my time to write. And, you know, I was writing plays and writing musicals and writing comedy, and life was full with, you know, little kids and the TV show, and the extra attention that came from that TV show, I kind of used that capital to try and manipulate as many theatre companies as I could into putting on my shows. And it worked, so that was good.
Yeah.
And it was a very frenetic time. I mean, God, you know, it's hard enough. People that have got little kids would know, you know, how consuming that is. But, you know, between my wife and I, we were both working, but we both made it work, and it was a really lovely, really lovely kind of 5 years of my life. The longest job I've ever had, ever.
Yeah. Well, what do you tell people, Eddie, who covet the sort of career that you have, not just as a performer, but as a writer now, and who has had the opportunities that you've had? I mean, some people would covet that, but then at the same time, balk, say, at how much work goes into that. What would you tell them?
Well, I mean, if you're balking at the amount of work, it's probably not. Probably not for you. I think that's a pretty fair enough assessment. Mm. But I mean, the work is made easier when you really love what it is you're doing. And I mean, everybody knows what it's like to be. I think, you know, the most kind of discouraged people I meet in their 20s, and they remind me of me in my 20s. And I think I got discouraged a lot in my 20s as well, because I knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't have anyone that was going to back me or support me, and I had to do it myself. And every time I thought, this is it, this is the, you know, I've got enough runs on the board, someone's going to come along and make my life easier, that really didn't happen. And I thought I was ready for a lot of big opportunities, I thought I was ready to step up, and when they didn't come, I got very discouraged. But my discouragement and my roadblocks and the closed doors were the things that sent me back to write more. And then I would write something else, and I go, well, this is a lot better than the last one. And then I would go back and write again, and I got better again. And eventually I got less afraid of writing. I just knew that if I sat down at the piano on this day to write this song, I would write it. And, you know, that only came because I had to. And, you know, I think it's important. I mean, I just call it my shit-kicking 20s, where I did every gig under the sun. I musically directed people's cabarets. I wrote songs for other artists. I performed in fringe shows for no money. I wrote fringe shows with other people. You know, I did weird comedy clubs. I did strange comedy tours. I did, you know, plays and readings. And, you know, the only thing you can really do is take every opportunity that comes your way and make sure you don't sell that opportunity short, even if there's 5 people in the audience. And sometimes there weren't 5 people in the audience. Like this, you know, you have this brilliant chance to hone your craft no matter how many people are sitting there. And you never know who's watching, and you never know what opportunity is going to come from the one that you're working on. And you just really need to make relationships with people, and create great rapport with people, collaborate with people, to work really hard and every job, maximize every opportunity, because you just never know what's next. And it just grows very slowly. It's a very, for me, some people, I mean, I used to look around at people getting, like, kind of quite famous or getting a lot of attention or a lot of profile very quickly, but mine was very incremental, and I've grown to be grateful for that glacial pace at which, you know, the opportunities got larger and larger. If they'd come at a rush, I wouldn't be the writer I am today, I don't think.
Yeah, there are marvelous lessons there, and a great deal of creativity and talent in your work that's to admire. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today, Eddie. Thanks for this, and all the best with everything else.
Yeah, lovely talking to you too, and thank you so much for taking the time to have me on your show.
The original Broadway cast recording of Beetlejuice is available for streaming on Spotify, and the physical CD is available tomorrow, Friday the 11th of October. Visit ghostlightrecords.com for more information. At Eddie Perfect is his Twitter handle. Eddie Perfect joined me on the line from New York City. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.